Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to be hosting this FedSoc Forum, the Courthouse Steps decision, focusing on two related cases, EPA versus Calumet Shreveport Refining and Oklahoma versus EPA. We're very pleased to welcome our excellent speaker, James Conde, to this discussion, who is a partner at Gordon Gray. And special thanks to Garrett Crowell for moderating this event. Garrett is an associate at DLA Piper. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speaker, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. And near the end of the program, we'll turn to the audience for questions. So if you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. And finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers and not the Federalist Society. With that, Garrett, thanks so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thanks, Edie, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this event. Hello, everyone. My name is Garrett Crowell, and I will be your moderator today. With us, we have James Conde, who is a partner at the law firm Boyd & Gray, where he specializes in administrative law, specifically Cleaner Act issues. So he's the perfect person to have with us today to discuss two recent Supreme Court decisions on the interpretation of the Clean Air Act's venue provision, and specifically an exception to that provision. So two other housekeeping notes I'll make up front. We did a similar webinar the day or two after oral argument, James and I did, and give our initial impressions there. So that's worth a listen if you've got the time. And second, using that Q&A chat function there, enter in some questions, and we will endeavor to get to those audience questions at the end. James is going to do about 20 to 30 minutes of his take on these decisions, and then back to audience questions. So without further ado, over to you, James.
All right. Well, thanks, Edith and Garrett, and thank you to the Federal Society for inviting me to speak about the two venue decisions issued by the Supreme Court last Wednesday, June 18th. So the decisions are styled EPA versus Calumet Refining and then Oklahoma versus EPA. There are two separate cases. The first case, EPA versus Calumet Refining, sort of was the more controversial or the closer case. The case ended up with an unusual 7-2 lineup, with Justice Thomas writing a majority opinion and Gorsuch writing a dissent, joined by the Chief Justice. And I think really most of the case turns on the dispute, really turns on the idea that venue rules should be read to be clear. And I think this is captured by the line ending the Gorsuch dissent, which says, and I quote, "At the end of the day, venue rules are like traffic laws. They simply tell litigants where they go, and they should be easy to follow." So I'll let you decide whether the metaphor is a good one, but the basic point that I think the Justice Gorsuch and the Chief are making in dissent is that their venue rules should be construed to favor clarity for litigants and judges, perhaps even when that might not be the best reading of the text. Now, that's right. So Gorsuch appears to, in his dissent, arguing in favor of a less strictly textualist approach to venue provisions, perhaps. And for putting a minor thumb on the scale, at least, in favor of readings of venue provisions that will avoid wasteful litigation on questions of where to go to court. The majority, by contrast, will have none of that. I think the answer from Justice Thomas to Justice Gorsuch is essentially, as I will discuss in a little more detail later, that taking into account pragmatic concerns about clarity and waste in interpreting venue provisions is not something that judges should do. That's a question for Congress. And the question for judges is really sort of just applying the text as, you know, the best we can to the situation before us without any thumbs on the scale in favor of clarity. So I think really that's the dividing line between the majority and the dissent. And so just getting to the actual text of the venue provision, and we discussed this in more detail in our prior podcast, so I'm going to go fairly quickly, but as Justice Thomas puts it, the Clean Air Act's venue provision has three parts. First, the provision says, the national actions, and it lists several of them, such as national ambient air quality standards, have to go to the DC Circuit. And then it has a catch-all provision saying that, quote, nationally applicable final actions go to the DC Circuit. Then the second part of the statute lists several regional actions, like approvals of a state implementation plan. Then it has a similar catch-all that says, quote, local or regionally applicable actions have to go to the appropriate circuit. So, for example, a approval of a state plan, if somebody challenges that, like Sierra Club challenges the approval of Oklahoma's state plan, they have to go to the regional circuit, which then would be the 10th Circuit, for example. Then third, the statute contains an exception to the second category of cases, which allows EPA to route cases to the DC Circuit. So as I explained in the prior podcast we did, I call this exception the Frick exception because it was proposed by the General Counsel of EPA, William Frick, and became eventually part of the 1977 amendments to the Clean Air Act. So the Frick exception, and I'm going to quote the whole text here because this provision is essential to this case. The exception says, notwithstanding the preceding sentence, meaning the sentence providing for review in regional circuits of regional action, a petition for review may be filed only in the DC Circuit if, quote, such action is based on a determination of nationwide scope or effect, and if, in taking such action, EPA finds and publishes that such action is based on such a determination. So, to sum that up, local or regional actions have to go to a regional circuit unless EPA finds that the action is, one, based on a determination of nationwide scope or effect, and two, EPA publishes such a finding in the Federal Register. Now, to talk about the sort of background dispute in the CalNet decision, it arises from the Clean Air Act's Renewable Fuel Standard Program, which requires obligated parties, meaning in this case, petroleum refiners, to blend certain quantities of renewable fuel into transportation fuel or to buy credits from other entities that blend renewable fuel. Crucially here, though, the RFS exempts small refineries that apply for an exemption if they can prove they, quote, suffer disproportionate economic hardship. Now, these applications are usually called SREs, small refinery exemptions, so I'm going to call them SREs through the rest of the teleforum. So what happened here is that EPA essentially denied SREs and MAS in two different Federal Register notices, one denying 36 SREs and one denying 69 SREs all over the country. And in doing so, EPA claimed that these denials were all, quote, nationally applicable actions that had to be challenged in the DC Circuit, and also claimed that the Frick exception applied, that the decisions were based on a determination of nationwide scope or effect. In doing so, EPA pointed to two aspects of its reasoning that it said qualified as determinations of nationwide scope or effect. So the first was EPA's conclusion that disproportionate economic hardship means disproportionate economic hardship caused by the RFS, not other factors like, for example, let's say COVID-19. In other words, the RFS has to be the cause of hardship. The second was EPA's rebuttable presumption based on its economic understanding of national fuel markets. The refiners are able to pass through the costs of the RFS to consumers and thus suffer no economic hardship because of the RFS. Again, I think that it's important to note that that presumption was rebuttable. In other words, individual refineries could go to EPA and say, In our case, we cannot pass through the cost because of, for example, local conditions that limit our ability to pass through to consumers. So even though EPA said that these cases belonged in the DC circuit, small refineries brought challenges all across the country in many regional circuits. And by and large, courts agreed with EPA that the challenges should be heard in the DC circuit. The Fifth Circuit, however, disagreed with EPA's venue determination and kept the case in the Fifth Circuit and eventually ruled against the EPA in a case implicating, I think, six SREs in particular. As the Fifth Circuit saw it, because the presumption was rebuttable and the court still had to consider local arguments about specific refineries in, say, for example, Texas, the exception was not satisfied. Now, EPA sought cert on the question of venue, and the court reversed the Fifth Circuit in a 7-2 decision. Now, let's walk through the majority opinion and how the court approaches the question of venue here. So the first part of the opinion is really part two, and it deals with the question of whether the relevant action here is national action that has to go to the DC circuit or regional action that in general goes to regional circuits unless the FRIC exception applies. So the court, walking through the text of the provision, says that the term action in the Clean Air Act means a specific action authorized by the text of the Clean Air Act, such as, for example, approving a SIP, and not, crucially, not how EPA chooses to package its actions in the federal in a federal register notice. So the court also says that nationwide or nationally applicable means that the actions apply nationwide. And obviously regional actions are ones that are less than nationwide. Interestingly, however, the court has a footnote in the decision, footnote two, that reserves the question of whether regulations that cover most of the nation but exclude, say, Alaska or Hawaii are actions of nationwide applicability. This actually matters because several Clean Air Act regulatory programs, including some fuels programs, as the court points out in a footnote, apply only to the contiguous United States and not to Alaska or Hawaii. And so that question, at least in theory, remains open after this case. And so the court essentially says we don't have a nationally applicable action here because the action that is relevant here is the denial of a specific refinery application. And that is, you know, a refinery by refinery process, and it applies only to a specific refinery, not across the nation. And the court rejects EPA's theory that essentially by bundling these denials in a single Federal Register notice, that somehow makes it a nationally applicable action. The court also rejects the argument that the interveners supporting EPA made, essentially the biofuels producers that benefit from the standards, intervene in the case. And they had a different argument, which was because there are follow-on consequences from the approval or the denial of an exemption, namely that EPA has to, in its view, reallocate the obligations to other refineries across the nation, that somehow made it nationally applicable too. And the Supreme Court says, no, that does not make it nationally applicable. You look at, and this is the quote from the court, is you look at the face of the action. So you don't consider follow-on legal or practical effects. You just look at the face of the action itself and whether that is nationally applicable or regionally applicable. So I think the court is unanimous on part two, and that provides some useful clarity going forward. The second question the court addresses, and the more controversial one, is whether the so-called Frick exception is satisfied in this case. And that's part three of the opinion, which divides the court 7-2. So now the court says, yes, the EPA did satisfy the Frick exception case, and so the case belongs in the D.C. Circuit. And the court says that essentially that follows from an ordinary meaning approach to the venue provision. And so just walking through how the court construes the Frick exception, the court first says the term determination means a justification or explanation that EPA gives for its action. So to put that in context here, the decision that that there's a rebuttable presumption in favor of pass-through is a determination or an explanation that EPA gives, and the statutory interpretation saying that the economic hardship has to follow from the RFS and not other factors, both of those are determinations under the exception. Then the court explains what nationwide scope means. And it says it means that the determination applies throughout the whole nation as a matter of law. So legally speaking, the conclusion applies throughout the nation. And then effect, the court says, the decision practically applies throughout the nation, even if not legally speaking, the effects of it are going to be felt throughout the nation. Not clear exactly what that will mean going forward, but in any event, I think the court says that here, both the decisions are of nationwide scope because they apply to refineries that seek exemptions across the nation. Now, the court really says that the key question is, how do we construe the term based on? So that, just as a reminder, the Frick exception says that the determination has to be based, the EPA can send actions to the DC Circuit if the determination is based on if the action is based on a determination of nationwide scope or effect. So the key question is, what does based on mean in this context? And the court says that it has to mean something more than but-for causation. So I think a lot of listeners might be familiar with Bostock, right? That construes the term because, which is similar to based on, to mean but-for causation. So if a factor yields a certain result, then it is ipso facto a but-for causation, even though it's only a minimal factor and not really the driver of the decision. So just to use the Bostock example, right, you have a gay employee that's fired by the employer because the employee is gay. And in doing so, the employer considered the employee's sex, even though the employer was truly and primarily motivated by the sexual orientation of the employee. Sex, at least Bostock tells us, was still a but-for factor in the decision. And therefore, the but-for causation is sort of a broad standard. But the court says that can't be what based on means here, because otherwise the Frick exception would swallow the rule. EPA always interprets the Clean Air Act and must do so even-handedly to all entities. And so every act of EPA interpretation could effectively be deemed a determination of nationwide scope or effect if you take a broad view of but-for causation. And so the court says, in this context, based on has to mean more like the core justification or the primary justification or the gravamen for the action that EPA took. So putting this all together, the court says, and I quote, and this is the rule that comes out of the court's decision, is put more concretely, An EPA action is based on the determination of nationwide scope or effect only if a justification of nationwide breadth is the primary explanation for and driver of EPA's action. But, the court says, and I quote, a determination of nationwide scope or effect does not rise to this level if EPA also relied in significant part on other, quote, intensely factual considerations, or if the key driver of EPA's action is otherwise debatable, unquote. So just to review that rule again, if EPA's determination is the primary explanation for and driver of EPA's action, EPA can claim this exception and route cases to the DC Circuit. But if EPA also relied on intensely factual considerations that are local, or if the key driver of EPA's action is otherwise debatable, then EPA cannot route cases to the DC Circuit. So that's the rule. And the Supreme Court says, and this is important, that courts should analyze this question de novo, meaning without any deference to EPA's claim that an action is based on a determination of nationwide scope or effect. So applying that rule to the facts of CalumNet refining, the court says that essentially EPA's statutory interpretation of the RFS to say that economic hardship has to result from the RFS itself and not other factors, and EPA's rebuttable presumption of economic pass-through, were really the driver of EPA's decision, the whole ballgame. And even though the presumption was in theory rebuttable, the court sort of viewed EPA's actions as more or less ordained by these determinations or explanations. And so therefore, EPA properly claimed that the decisions could be routed to the DC Circuit under the Frick exception. And the Supreme Court disagrees with the Fifth Circuit's analysis, saying essentially, well, the statute says based on, not solely based on. And so even though the refineries were pressing some refinery-specific local challenges, those are not the, you know, that's not the gravamen or the sort of core justification for EPA's decision. And so Fifth Circuit, you got it wrong. So just to explain how the rule applies to a different case, we had a parallel case alongside the CalumNet refining decision involving a disapproval of two state implementation plans. So these cases arose from EPA's determination that the ozone standard was not sufficiently low in 2015, and it issued a new national ambient air quality standard, which triggered the obligations of several states to submit state implementation plans to comply with their Clean Air Act obligations. And in doing so, the Clean Air Act says that you essentially have to be a good neighbor. You can't significantly contribute to non-attainment in another state. And to the extent you do significantly contribute to non-attainment in another state, you have to take enforceable actions to essentially stop that contribution to a downwind state. And so what EPA did in assessing whether states had met good neighbor obligations is that it applied a common framework essentially to reach its conclusions. EPA called it a four-step framework. But you know, ultimately the court said all of these decisions turned on the specific analysis of each state's regional conditions and specific evidence. And the court said that was too intensely local to trigger the Frick exception. So we have two useful cases now to sort of try to construe the venue provision. One of them, you know, the driver was really a national determination. The other, the court says, you know, involved questions that were too intensely local, and you know, that whether any of the four factors that EPA applied in common to all these different SIP plans, where the driver is sort of disputed or debatable. And so therefore, at least in the state SIP case, that was not sufficient to trigger the FRIC exception. So now I'll end by talking a little bit about the Gorsuch dissent and the majority's response to the dissent. And as I mentioned at the very, the opening of my remarks, Gorsuch's dissent really seems to be driven by this pragmatic concern with the idea that venue determinations have to be simple, and that the way the court has construed the FRIC exception will require a sort of complicated inquiry and a peek at the merits, and that's not ideal for deciding where a case should be litigated. And it's going to, generate some wasteful litigation going forward. So as he points out, what makes a justification the primary driver? Often when EPA makes a decision, it does so because of multiple reasons, all of which reinforce each other. And how are judges supposed to decide really which is the most important, or which is the core or primary driver motivating the end result? That's going to be difficult to do in at least some cases. And also the courts, rule that intensely local cases can't trigger the FRIC exception. That's also going to be, a topic of dispute going forward. How intensely local does a reason have to be to essentially make the FRIC exception inapplicable? We won't know that for some time. I think there's going to be a rich field of litigation going forward, I think, in future Democratic administrations that will have an interest in routing cases, at least edge cases, to the DC Circuit, where I think they can presumably get a better outcome than in some circuits that might lean more conservative, such as the Fifth Circuit or the Sixth Circuit. So a lot of questions unresolved, and Justice Gorsuch and the Chief don't like that. They would have argued instead for a narrowed reading of the word determination in the FRIC exception. So they would read determination as a term of art that limits the exception to determination specifically required by the text of the Clean Air Act. So for example, Gorsuch's best example is a provision in the RFS that allows EPA to waive RFS standards. And this is a quote, based on a determination that enforcing them would, quote, severely harm the economy or environment of a state or region or the United States. So there, the statute specifically calls for a determination in taking the action, the waiver, and allows that determination to be either state focused, regionally focused, or focused on the United States as a whole. In other words, the whole nation. And that's the kind of determination that could trigger the FRIC exception. But, mere sort of justifications used by EPA that are not actually, do not appear on the text of the relevant Clean Air Act provision should not count. That's essentially the view articulated by Justice Gorsuch and the Chief. And I think really what drives them to sort of take a term of art approach to the word determination is that they would put a premium on clarity when it comes to venue provisions. And so they would interpret the venue provision narrowly. Now, the majority's response to that, in essence, is that it's not our job to narrow a poorly constructed venue provision, that concern is really one that should be taken to Congress. And, we have no reason to think that Congress use determination in sort of a term of art fashion, as opposed to the ordinary meaning of the term determination to mean just a justification or explanation. And so therefore, we're not persuaded by your dissent, Justice Gorsuch. So that's essentially the you know, the summary of the two cases and the new rule the Supreme Court has adopted for interpreting the venue provisions of the Clean Air Act. As I said, there's going to be, you know, some questions that are left open there and probably a lot of litigation in future administrations about, you know, edge cases under the Clean Air Act where you could, you know, EPA could claim that at least some sort of nationwide explanation for its action is a sufficient driver to route cases to the DC Circuit whenever EPA thinks that's a more favorable venue to tee up the challenges. So with that, Garrett, I'll close my remarks and we can go to questions.
Perfect. Thanks, James. I appreciate that. While the venue provision of the Clean Air Act is supposed to be a simple matter, it did take a couple dozen pages of two different cases for the Supreme Court to recently explain. So appreciate you walking us through that. I don't see many questions in the chat function right now. So if you do have a question, now would be the time to enter it in. I'll go ahead and start by just asking a very simple question. What's the practical outcome for the parties in these disputes? One case goes back out to the regional circuits and one goes back into the DC circuit. Is that right?
That's right. So the Oklahoma and Utah cases go back to the 10th circuit. And now the 10th circuit is going to have to hear the merits challenges. Possibly if the new administration is reconsidering the denial of the SIP plans, those cases could be held in abeyance anyway while the new administration works through, reconsidering the actions the prior administration took. So it's not clear that the 10th Circuit is actually going to issue a decision on the merits, but in theory, at least, the case now should litigate on the merits or else paused as the new administration revisits the prior actions the Biden administration took. And on the RFS exemptions case, presumably, the case when the Fifth Circuit is reversed, it will be remanded to the Fifth Circuit and transferred to the DC Circuit. Presumably, I assume the Fifth Circuit merits decision that came out before the Supreme Court venue decision will be vacated as well. And so the refineries will lose the benefit of that judgment. And they will go to the DC Circuit, which, by the way, has also already held that these exemption denials were unlawful. So they would go to the DC Circuit and presumably win on the merits based on stare decisis. That said, I think the DC Circuit's reasons for invalidating the denials of the SRE exemptions were narrower than those of the Fifth Circuit. So it's less of a win for the refiners, but I think they should probably win anyways once the cases get transferred to the DC Circuit. So I think that's how the cases are going to turn out now.
Thanks. Yeah, that's an important kind of threshold question for our audience and certainly a question of great importance for the parties to the actual disputes. What do you think might happen in this administration given the court's, you know, rulings in these decisions? You mentioned future Democrat administrations, presumably the Clean Air Act, the EPA is going to take some type of Clean Air Act actions over the next couple of years. What might these decisions mean for those Clean Air Act rulemakings? Perhaps the answer is maybe not much, given that there was unity or clarity. I mean, 8-0, 7-2 in these decisions, but I'd be interested in your thoughts.
Right. So I think the court's interpretation of nationwide applicability is going to be helpful to the administration if the administration rather not send cases to the DC Circuit. Because the court takes a rather sort of, I would say, correct but narrow approach to the term nationally applicable final action. So that will help because if EPA doesn't want to make a finding that a determination, that an action is based on a determination of nationwide scope or effect. It doesn't have to, right? The statute gives the agency the choice. And if the agency never makes that finding, it doesn't trigger the Frick exception. And so that allows EPA essentially to decide that cases should go to regional circuits rather than the DC circuit. So that is probably going to be flexibility for the new administration. Previously, for example, to take the 10th Circuit case, the 10th Circuit there had said that because EPA had bundled the denials together, that was made it nationally applicable. So now, even if EPA decides to sort of reverse those decisions in the bundled Federal Register notice saying, we think we got it wrong and here are our reasons, then that still gets to go to the regional circuit so long as EPA does not sort of make a decision based that it's based on a determination of nationwide scope or effect. And similarly, decisions that you might argue are based on an explanation that is nationwide, like a new statutory interpretation issue that the EPA resolves for a ton of entities at the same time. So long as EPA does not make the finding that it's based on a determination of nationwide scope or effect, that decision can be challenged in regional circuits. Now, I'm not sure that that's actually something that the Trump administration is going to want to do, because at least for certain states, for circuit and the First Circuit might not be more favorable venues than the DC Circuit for a lot of action. So we'll see how it plays out. But at the very least, EPA has now more flexibility to not trigger the exception if it doesn't want to. And not route cases to the DC Circuit if it doesn't want to.
All good points. Audience, if you have a question, now would be the time to enter it. If not, I'll ask one more and give Jimmy some room to offer any closing thoughts if you'd like, and then we can wrap up. It's nice from the agency's perspective to have some flexibility like that offered in the venue provision. You touched on that in your prior remarks there. Are there things that the agency could do in undertaking rulemakings that with an eye towards state-specific analysis, for example, or nationally applicable reasoning that could help guide rulemakings into proper circuits?
Oh, yes. So, the first thing an agency should do if it wants to guide decisions to the regional circuit is not mention the Frick exception and not say it's based on a determination of nationwide scope or effect. But also, making, as opposed to sweeping national arguments about the meaning of the Clean Air Act, making decisions based on specific local considerations is also going to help prevent cases from being routed to the DC circuit. So yes, the answer is yes. The agency can do a lot of things to make its decisions look more local than national. And the agency can also publish its decisions in separate Federal Register notices as opposed to aggregating them as EPA did here. So there's a lot the agency can do to sort of route cases to its preferred venue if it wants to.
Very good. All right, then. Any closing thoughts you'd like to offer, or should we just go ahead and wrap it up?
I'll just say that, I think it's a bit of a missed opportunity for the court. I was hoping that the court was going to be a little more pragmatic and less strictly textualist about venue provisions specifically, because As I mentioned, you know, litigating venue is always a big waste of money and resources. And there's something to be said for an approach of reading venue provisions sort of narrowly and strictly so that they generate the least social waste possible. And a lot of, you know, judicial resources and attorney resources are not wasted in debating questions of venue. It seems pretty clear from the majority decision that that's not an approach that a majority of the Supreme Court is going to adopt. So they're going to say, you know, the statute means what it means. And if Congress wants to write clearer venue provisions, it's up to them. But we're not going to put a thumb on the scale on just to make venue provisions clear. So I think that's unfortunate, but I can see why the Supreme Court would do what it did here.
Certainly. Well, thanks again, James, for taking your time and sharing your expertise on these important decisions. And thank you to our audience for tuning in. It's nice to see some familiar names in the participant list there. Edie, I think we're about done. So if you'd like to take it out, that'd be much appreciated.
Yeah, on behalf of the Federalist Society, thanks so much to James and Garrett for speaking with us today. We really appreciate your time and expertise. And thank you also to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate you tuning in. You can stay up to date with other announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.